Welcome to Superlative. I am your podcast host, Ariel Adams. In each episode, you will meet someone who has inspired or takes inspiration from today's wristwatch industry. Every week, let's dive deep into the world of crafting exotic timepieces from the people who dream them up to the people who dream of them. It's time to get started and meet today's guest. Hey everyone, Ariel Adams here with the Superlative Podcast. My guest today is Simon Wolf of Wolf 1834. Simon, welcome.
Thank you very much. Welcome, welcome.
Before we started this, I was thinking that one of the first time we met was, and it was quite a while ago. I believe it was at JCK probably. You think that's maybe where it was?
Your memory is better than mine. Probably, yes, probably there. I'm trying to see if there's... I met you on August 9th, 2011. That's how detailed I am. I put it in my calendar.
You actually have the date?
I have that I met you on August 9th. Now, I didn't say where. I normally put that in as well. So I don't like the word anal, but I have a good memory, but sometimes
okay.
I'm not so good with people and names and places. So I put in my contact for you. So yeah, August 9th.
That wouldn't have been
JCK. I think you came to my office.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Look, here's the thing. You definitely show at JCK or did. You know, I think one of the things I want to discuss is how Wolf is a very interesting company. Now, what Wolf does is you make watch winders, you make watch boxes, you make jewelry boxes, you make a bunch of stuff like that. But the 13 years you've known me pales in comparison to the 190-year history of the brand. And today you do some things different than sort of you used to do, but you are a fifth generation owner uh-huh. of this company. You don't make watches, but boy, does this sound like a watch company, right?
Yeah, we've got some heritage. We've got longevity. We've got fantastic history. It all started with an idea that my great-great-grandfather had back in 1834. He was a silversmith in Hanau, Germany, and he thought, maybe my jewelry and my other pieces that I make in silver would look nicer in a box. So he started making little leather boxes.
Where was it displayed before, if not a box? Was it given in paper? It was like, here's your newspaper wrapped jewelry?
You know, I don't actually know the answer to that. But let's put it this way. They probably were being put in some kind of a container. The container quality level design look wasn't as good as perhaps my great-great-grandfather therefore developed. So I would think it was probably just an improvement because there were boxes. There's always been a box out there. but we just always made them better. So that's probably what happened.
So it began with jewelry.
Yeah. He made all sorts of different silver, anything out of silver. And his father before him was a goldsmith in Hanau, Germany.
Were the first boxes also made out of silver?
Some of them were. We have no evidence of that. We just know that through, the stories passed down, they don't really last 190 years unless they're written. And through the sands of time, things have been lost. So I can't say definitively. But being a silversmith, yeah, he was making all manner of things out of silver, for sure.
Okay, so talk a little bit about, I'm just curious, whatever records you have, what changed the business from being a silversmith to a box maker? I don't know the cool name for box maker.
I think box making sounds really cool. That's what I am. It's like anything. I think when you become good at something, so he was a good silversmith, I'm assuming, and he started making these lovely little leather boxes, and other silversmiths in that area started to get interested because it was a very closed community and everybody, chatted and talked to each other. It ignited something in him. And, what's the beginning of any good idea is started in your own head, of course, but you have to be encouraged. You have to have something that then is a spark to make you go forward and develop something. And I think he, perhaps he just didn't like silversmithing as much as he liked making little boxes, you know?
Well, we know that happened, these craftsman centers, especially in Europe, what you'd have is you'd have a region and everyone would do the same thing, right? They'd make the same watch parts. They'd make, you know, jewelry bracelets. They'd make boxes. And they'd all do the same thing. And there's a lot of camaraderie, but also competition. But all of a sudden, if one of them makes something that the others need, now they become a supplier as opposed to a competitor.
Exactly, exactly. And that's what happened. And then jumping from there, his son, so that's Philip Wolf II, he went to first Denmark and then Sweden. And his father said, let's spread this out. Let's see where else we could sell these boxes. So, you know, that was the first step sort of westwards that we made. That was more like north from Germany, but up to Malmo, Sweden. And he met a lovely woman by the name of Ida, who's massively important in the story. And she won his heart, and he never went back to Germany. So he immigrated into Sweden and continued the business, the box-making business there. Of course, still going back to Hanau, but... that was sort of the next sort of step was into Sweden.
So first it was, we're making boxes for the fellow silversmiths. Now it's, we're going to move and we're also going to make boxes that are going to be shipped out to a larger territory.
Exactly. And I think that's something that has always been in our DNA as a family. My desire to get on a plane, which you can now obviously do for many years, or discover a new market or find a new market, it was there, you know, 190 years ago. So my great-great-grandfather thought, go on, go. And everyone was called Philip up until me. So it was Philip being told by Philip, go get some more business. Yeah, let's see if this is scalable. I don't think they use that word. I don't know what the word is in German. But let's go see... If there's something else out there, went to Denmark, went to Sweden, met Ida, fell in love, loved Southern Sweden, so stayed. And that's that sort of discovery, sort of forging to new markets. I mean, fast forward in 1988, I went to America, you know, as a 22-year-old, and somehow managed to, you know, keep going and not get disheartened over all the years that it wasn't working. So we're now in Sweden. 1920s, and the business a little bit earlier than that, actually more like a 1905-ish sort of time frame, and developing a business. And of course, you got to remember the workshop was probably 8, 10, 12 people. We've got some lovely old pictures of the people who worked in the factory. Not a factory, it was a workshop. Very small scale, of course, because everything was back then. There was no way of moving massive amounts of goods somewhere they weren't necessarily needed either. So it was really another stage in the development of the brand.
What kind of boxes were they making about 100 years ago? And for what purposes?
For jewelry. Jewelry, watches. You know, if you step forward another generation to my grandfather, he was an incredibly inventive man, and he was always coming up with new ideas, solutions. So, he'd have a customer that had, perhaps they needed a box for a set of knives or something. So he was an entrepreneur that was inventive. So he invented a new way to hinge a box, a lid and base. He was very involved with the environment and did studies on the health of the rivers and streams in southern Sweden, wrote books about it, went to America, wrote a book about the salmon in America and the runs and the health of the water. So he had that inquisitive mind. He was the guy that invented the little ballerina box that every little girl has had, the little paper wrap box with a little ballerina inside.
Yeah.
He invented that back in the 60s and put a music movement in it. So, yeah, the family has had, I think, just the not the ability, but just the desire If you come to me with an idea and it's a good one, I'll love to try and make it for you because that's what we do. We're inventive, and that's obviously continues through to today.
I want to clarify, especially for the people listening, they may not know, were these boxes that people would buy as a third-party box, as an accessory, or were these also boxes that would be sold to a manufacturer that the product would come in when you purchased it as a consumer? Because those are two very different things.
Yeah, so back in the day of you know, turn of the century, we were very much a packaging company, and I you know, I say that word with some sort of trepidation because we're no longer that. But we really started our journey making a box that somebody else could put a product in and then sell to their customer. Yeah, that's exactly right. But by the time that my grandfather in the mid-30s was really developing the business, he saw that, you know, that type of box, you know, although you could be creative and it could be beautiful, there was another business that was looking after a watch, looking after jewelry in a broader sense. So when you're at home and you need to put it somewhere, that's what he started developing watch boxes for, you know, not just one watch as a presentation from the retailer, but as a thing that you could put not just your watch in, cufflinks, collar stay, you know, all those kinds of items that a person has. And that's really in the 30s that started to gather sort of steam, so to speak.
I'm going to ask a little bit of a different but a related question. If you've been in the watch industry or pretty much any industry for any amount of time now, you'll know that in the, we'll just call it the Far East, there's a prolific amount of packaging makers, right? All types of companies that want to make your packaging. And the cost of some of those can be low, some of them can be high. And my question is, when did this sort of mass-produced packaging industry, maybe it started in the Far East, maybe not, when did that begin? Because my inclination is that for the most part, this was a cottage industry, the making packages for your own stuff or for other people's goods. And then I don't know when it happened, but it seemed to be this basically volume-based economy where it's a lot of inexpensive stuff. And it's very difficult to decide, you know, should I buy the really nice one or the not nice one? I'm just wondering, when did that all start?
So the watch brands, the jewelry brands, the retailers in the 60s and early 70s, mid-70s, were buying from my grandfather's factory in southern Sweden, in Malmo, and from my father's factory in southern Wales, in Llanelli. And that changed through very late 70s. China, Thailand started to get better and better at producing a box. And I remember distinctly because we were doing, you know, heavily packaging in the 80s, early 80s, before I went to America in 88. And there was this this moment when, you know, my father was very concerned about the business. I mean, we were making very simple boxes, you know, for a brand like Secondo, where we were making, I can't remember how many millions of boxes we were making. I had one machine and we were just pumping these things out. You know, we'd made for Rolex and we'd made for Satina and we made it for Ulysanda. And I have some wonderful old samples that we've discovered in a loft in an old mill that my grandfather owned in Sweden. And I'll be doing a whole story about that when I can get to going through these literally tens and tens of boxes of these samples. Cool. But we realized that as the business went to, you know, the Far East, it was about price and it became a commodity. And it was about producing something for a price. And, you know, whether it was H. Samuel, Ernest Jones, or whoever in the UK, I speak to the UK a lot. That's where I'm from and that's where I live now. And that was the main core of the business in Europe as well, not so much America. And it upended our business. So we had to, you know, we had to really look at, well, what do we do as a company? And if we can't be competitive because of what's happening in the marketplace, we'll shift a little bit. And that shift, we were very slow to make the shift. We had huge problems in the end of the 80s and very early 90s. So financially, very, very tough times. You know, I was scrabbling around trying to make a living and finding it very difficult. But that's another part of the story is, you know, we refocused our box making skills into, you know, watch care, jewelry care. We make safes now. We have small leather goods. I mean, we've diversified massively, and that re-energized the business. But that started really with me in the early 90s, where I saw that, you know, we couldn't exist trying to make a box that was, you know, being undersold by whatever factory.
And I mean, I have to say, I've seen a lot of boxes and packaging, and it's interesting because you see a lot of the stuff from Asia. Some of it's fantastic, but a lot of what I've seen is just crap. I've seen a lot of extremely bad packaging, but it looks like it's copying something that was nice packaging, right?
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating is this history of presentation. I mean, on the internet a while ago, there was sort of this trend of unboxing videos and things like that, right? And people sometimes don't think about it, but the experience you have with the product changes a lot with the packaging. And there's been a lot of different types of packaging over the years. We kind of joke about the boxes within boxes within boxes, right? And stuff like that. Yep. But if you just look at it today, it can be difficult to sort of understand all this. But maybe you can offer some thoughts on the evolution of the packaging as part of the luxury experience, because I've never purchased anything or seen any other type of product that puts so much thought, not in just the packaging in terms of the quality, but this strange ritual, if I will, of unboxing it and sometimes even reboxing it. And there's very few people who can talk about that side of it. You know, the watchmakers, they sort of stop at the watch, and very rarely do they think anything, you know, beyond that. But you are an expert on these and also an expert on the presentation. What can you say about how this sort of interesting subculture of luxury evolved?
Yeah, well, you know, part of the experience is unboxing whatever it is you get, the watch or the piece of jewelry. And as I said, we're not really in that world anymore, although we get asked to do boxes that have that presentation function, but are a higher level, a higher grade. We recently did a collection for Garrard's, the jewelers here in the UK. And they wanted a sustainable solution, so they buy a lot of boxes for all their boutiques and their retailers globally. And so we developed a sustainable solution for them. And each piece of packaging, whether it's a ring box, necklace, a set, is in a box. It will come to the consumer in a box that actually has an after use. So it's actually a jewelry case. So that's what I was saying earlier. We've moved away from being packaging many, many years ago, because it was much more of a commodity. It limited me creatively because, you know, there's not so much you can do. You just want to make the watch or the jewelry look good in the moment that it's opened. So what we're doing now is we're housing that jewelry, that multiple pieces once you've bought, and whether it's a single watch winder of 4, 6, 8, or some of the huge safes we do, that's a whole different world and where we live now.
Now, in the 90s, as you said, you sort of shifted over to making, I guess we could say, is a third party or an aftermarket thing. You had your items and then you wanted to store it in something. How did this begin? You know, were there leaders in the space? Did you know, obviously price and being able to manufacture had a big part of it. What were some of the major steps in changing the business from being a packaging supplier to being a product that people wanted to buy alone?
So, and you know, so your listeners get a sense of time. I mean, this doesn't happen. You don't just switch a flip a switch, and say that's a really good one, and decide one morning we're going to do that. It's gradual. I would say over a decade. You know, when I came into the business, we were probably 70% a packaging company, and the focus started to shift because of all the reasons we've already discussed. So for me, and what you see now, if you go to our website, wolf1834.com, you'll see what is my contribution over the last almost 35 years of, or more than that, actually being involved and running the company. Well, I've run the company for the last 25 years after my father, you know, handed the reins to me. So, you know, it was a case of diminishing returns. If you're competing with another box maker who's just making a six-sided box. It's very simple. It was a point of differentiation. There's no brand to that. It's just you can't brand yourself through the packaging.
Right.
And I realized that many, many years ago, and I thought, well, we have this amazing history. We've been doing this longer than most. We have a family that's always been involved. I mean, there's never been a break. We didn't go to sleep for 30 years, and then someone came and put some money in and re-energized us. So it's been handed down generation to generation for five of them, 190 years. And so that focus on, well, how do we keep this going, for me, was paramount. How do I keep the damn thing going so that we become a brand, we really become a brand that people want because we solve a problem for them or they identify with us. I mean, it's a classic straightforward branding process, but I'm not the smartest, person on the planet. So I think it took me a long time to piece things together so that I realized that I had some magic. It's magic to have what we have. And the depth of knowledge of how to make what we make. So we put it into making beautiful boxes for jewelry, for watches. That took, and is still taking time. I mean, we reinvent. I was just in Paris at Maison, and then at the show there, and then in Vicenza for the jewelry show there. And I'm looking at my own product, being critical, sending pictures back to the design team saying, I think we should make this little change here. And they are very small changes. And that devil in the details perspective that I have, I think, has put us, very much at the top of the pile of people in our world. And there are not very many people in our world because it's very difficult to make, as I said earlier, a six-sided box. It's actually very difficult when you think everything's cut or skived or embroidered, stitched. Everything's prepared. We use, we use a sewing machine, we use a cutting machine to do that. But once those parts are prepared, everything's by hand. They don't magically put this in one end of a machine and it comes out the other made. And there are hundreds of parts that go in to make a watch winder or a jewelry case. So it takes an enormous amount of skill and craft to be able to produce something. And you were saying earlier, there's a lot of crap out there that you see. We obviously don't make that. And it's taken, the last 30 years of my life of pushing the boundaries of not only design or the aesthetic of it, the use of it, but the detail. So we'll make changes internally in something, a product. You'll never see it. You'll never see it. The interiors of our safes, they weren't painted, and they're behind the modules. You don't see it. But it drove me mad because I know it's there. So now we paint the interior of the safe, which you don't need to do. So those sorts of things, those attention to detail, perspectives that we have as a company is what really has helped us become who we are today. And I think I've gone off on a bit of a tangent here and haven't really answered your question, perhaps, but you can ask it again. But we're doing a very very good job of protecting people's legacy. And that's one of our great little taglines.
Is a good tagline.
We're looking after things that you pass on, whether it's a watch, a piece of jewelry. There's not that many things that you pass on. A pair of shoes, I don't think so. Your car, maybe if it's a classic, but there aren't classics anymore. The latest Tesla will never be a classic.
Also a bit large for a box.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm just making I'm making the point that you don't really pass much on to those that come after you. Jewelry and watches is one of the main things, and we protect them. We keep them really safe in a beautiful box, whether you're at home or traveling.
I want to hear more about these technical stories, but I want to remark on the protecting your legacy, which is a slogan that you have come up with since. In the years between we first met and now. And I think it's very fascinating how you've sold not only these boxes, but you also have to sell the desire. You have to create the demand, and then you have to feed that demand. And that's one of the most interesting things about your space is while it's so obvious to many people, I need a box to store my precious stuff, getting them to buy it is sometimes a challenge. And, we've had interesting conversations in the past about like watch winders, for example. You make watch winders. I want to spend a whole long time talking about that. We'll get back to this. But even if you need a watch winder, the amount of people that actually go out and end up buying one is relatively low. So what you have done is you've created this slogan and this whole campaign around it, which is, you know, creating the desire. You know, you're marketing to a demographic, of course, that has these items and being like, hey, don't you need a place to put them? And that is so innovative and different than, like I said, in 2011 when we started talking. What really changed internally where you realize we're not just a company making good things, we now have to be a company that spreads the message that we make good things and why you might want them?
So making a connection with the consumer is very difficult when the product that you are selling most of the time sits at home. It is not worn on your wrist. You don't have the new latest handbag over your shoulder that you can show off to your friends you bought, or the car that you're driving is a representation of your status and what you like. I mean, clothes, everything. We represent not only our feelings for the day and what we dress up in and what we wear on our watch, but our status. And for us, it's been very difficult to make that connection to the consumer, because once you could do that and they love what you do and they want what you do and they feel that there's a lifestyle that is connected to that brand called Wolf, then you've got success. And that is where we started a long time ago on our journey to make that connection. And you know, then social media came along and Facebook and everything else. And the contact we can now have with a consumer is so much more direct than ever before. So we speak to them directly now, and you get a sense, they get a sense of who we are as a company, and you know, the energy that we have and the way that we treat them and you know, why we do what we do and we really care about it. It's you know, trying to be humble, we're further ahead than anybody else in our space, because we've just focused on taking care of people's things and talking about it. So you know, a few years ago we did this reach out through I think it was Instagram, must have been, and we asked people to send in a photograph of their beloved watch or piece of jewelry and why it meant something to them. And we were flooded with people. We still have it on our website. And these testimonials, and some of them were in a Wolf, some of them weren't. It didn't really matter. It was about what do you care about. And some of the items were, you know, very inexpensive, but they had a great sentimental value. And so that's, we keyed in on that, I suppose you would say, from a sort of a commercial point of view. I thought, well, that's something we can really speak to. And we did. And I think we've been very successful with, you know, Protect Your Legacy. That's what we do as a company. And we know that the consumer, the guy on the street, they care about their things. And so that's we just do more of that. And more of the connection, hopefully, to tell our story. And this year, being the 190th, we have five different products that are representative of each of the five generations, including myself. And those also, we were in Vicenza and in Maison. It was extraordinary to see people's reaction when they saw the Ida box. And we explained why it looked the way it looked. It's an old vintage trunk. Sort of, it has that feeling about it. And we've developed a box that you can now own that is inspired by Ida, this woman that was left with three kids, because she had two that died, and her husband, Philip Wolf II, really retreated from life. He was very depressed because of the loss of the two kids. She took over. So that's a human story. And it's wonderful, because without Ida, the company wouldn't have continued. It would have ended there back in 1907 or whatever. And she just persevered, dragged this trunk up and down Scandinavia, sold the products that were being made in the factory in Malmo. So one more, can you get more human than that?
But it's so different than...
It's that lovely connection.
Again, you know, 13 years ago, where I wouldn't say that this was purely a commodity business, but like you said, it was so difficult to find that connection. You know, that connection between the emotion? Because that's really what the watch is. You know, someone just sees a nice watch and they feel nothing. They hear a whole big story about where the design came from and how difficult it was to make and all the hours that craftspeople put into it. And all of a sudden, oh my gosh, I want that thing. What are some of those stories that apply to the boxes? I mean, obviously there isn't like someone's not, you know, polishing metal and making little gears, but what are some of those harder parts that make these truly luxurious and that if people knew about it, they'd be like, oh, I can appreciate that in a box the same way I can appreciate a story like that in a timepiece?
Yeah. We've done videos of the folks in the factory making the product and showing the handmade nature of the product. And I never want to say what we do is more difficult than anything else out there. It's incredibly challenging to make something that is got so many different pieces that all go together. And we don't just work in one, we just don't work in metal. We work in leathers. We use vegan leathers. We use different suedes. We have to deal with threads. We have to deal with the soft sponges we use. We have mirrors, locks, hardware. There's all these different elements that have to come together and work together. And so I think, you know, trying to explain to a person that this is what goes into making the product, it's, you know, I keep harping on about how difficult it is. We make it look really easy because when you look at the product, you go, wow, that's really beautiful. And I want one of those. Thank you very much. Take care of my watch. So there's that. We want to just have that reaction that they just love what they're looking at. We want to tell them how, you know, interesting it is to make it, how difficult it is to make it, because, you know, people appreciate craftsmanship. They appreciate that the stitch is in a straight line. They appreciate that the skived corners all, you know, match and line up perfectly. And of course, they appreciate what it does for them.
I wonder if an analogy would help people understand. I'm thinking about architecture. There is a lot of very poorly made homes that look nice when you're standing outside, right? Mm. And I'm thinking that it's sort of the same thing. Because a lot of the watch boxes that we've seen out there, they're designed to look nice, but once you examine the details, like you said, things don't line up. They're not glued together properly. I mean, how many watch boxes have you had? And again, we're talking about more the ones that come with products. The lid just comes right off, or within a couple of years, they're aging like horribly, or there's all these things that are peeling. But would you agree that it's sort of like construction quality, like you can follow the blueprints and make something amazing or crappy, and it's still following the blueprints. It's that attention to details and making sure that it doesn't just fit that design, but it's constructed in a way that is I don't know, durable and will last a little bit. Is that a good analogy or not?
Yeah, sure. It starts with the material. You know, whatever it is, if it's the lock, or if it's the leather, or if it's the mirror, or if it's the thread you're using, we buy the best or the appropriate. And I have, can't tell you how many times I see someone attempting to knock us off. And, you know, this is a serious form of flattery, is imitation. There's people that come with a knockoff, and for some crazy reason, they can't even copy us. I mean, they don't even get the sizing right.
Really?
I mean, if you're going to copy, just do the dimensions right, because there's a reason why it's 35 centimeters this way and 12 centimeters that way. There's a reason, and it's the aesthetic of it. It's the way it looks and the way it will sit and work, you know? Luckily, whoever's out there doing these knockoffs just doesn't pay enough attention to the first and foremost the materials that they're buying and using, because if the glue isn't decent or if the thread isn't tight, it'll fall apart eventually. And you know, we have watch winders and jewelry cases. I mean, they last a lifetime. They're made to last, and people see that when you pick it up. And you feel the weight of it, the construction, the way the hinge opens and closes. You can see very quickly that this is a quality product. If you have any sense of what quality is, you can see. And that, as I said earlier, it starts with the inside. So the inside out is what makes it look the way it looks and feel and function. So as I said, our watch winders, everything inside except the PC board and the motor, they're all ours. We created the tool, we produce everything, we assemble everything in our factory. So there's no room for someone saying, well, that was a bad batch. I mean, we just, it never happens. So our defective rate is almost zero with watch winders. It just doesn't happen.
Hi, this is Ariel Adams, founder of A Blog to Watch, with a message about eBay. I visit eBay daily and have been relying on eBay to learn about and acquire watches for more than 20 years. Did you know that you can now buy watches directly from brands or their authorized dealers on eBay? Timepieces coveted by watch enthusiasts from brands like Zodiac, Laco, Perlée, and more are part of eBay's Certified by Brand program. Here's how it works. Luxury names are partnering with eBay to bring brand new and pre-owned watches and other luxury accessories directly to you. Certified by Brand includes a minimum 1-year factory warranty for watches and offers an unprecedented selection of new and used watches directly from the source, all with the peace of mind you can expect from eBay. Visit ebay.com/certifiedbybrand for more information. If you haven't had the experience that I've had and you've had where you've got to handle a lot of these boxes, I'm guessing some of the things you're speaking are maybe a little bit vague, right? Or a little bit ambiguous because you're not really sure what you mean. But it's a really important point because a lot of the boxes, like, they suck. And I'm not just talking about the ones that come with products, like the aftermarket ones. They're really bad, and I'll focus on the example of watch winders. When I was a relatively novice watch collector starting out in the early 2000s and stuff like that, I bought a fair number of watch winders of various types. And one of the things that kind of blew my mind was that a lot of them would break, like, really fast. Like, within minutes, sometimes they would break. Like, this thing that you spent hundreds of dollars on would break within minutes. Often they would break within a few weeks or a few months. And then I stopped buying them because I was like, wait a minute, I'm not buying the cheapest ones, and I don't understand how this system where it's just turning a thing around breaks all the time. And I started to do more research, and then you and I started chatting, and I was chatting with the people at Orbita at the time. And I really learned that one of the issues was that in order to make it of a high quality enough at the price point, you had to have crazy volumes. But most of these watch winders were made with low volumes that you really couldn't engineer it to work properly. And again, if you haven't had that experience, you wouldn't think like, oh, I'm so happy to get a watch winder that works. But with the Wolf watch winders, I've never had that problem. They haven't stopped working. And it's a strange thing that's a big compliment. But, I mean, you know, right? And I don't know if they still make those bad watch winders. They must, I'm sure. But I'm going to argue that most budget watch winders, especially the no-name ones, they break, like, really fast. Is that still the case?
I don't really pay that much attention to what those guys are doing. I don't have to. But the fact that we are where we are in the growth of the company, the increase in revenue every year, you know, it's because we're making a product that's better than what else is out there on that very base level, and the brand and the story and everything else. So I would expect that, yes, they probably do have a problem still with overwinding a watch because they don't count turns per day, or magnetizing because they don't have a decent motor inside. So, you know, in all industries, there's the higher level and the lower level, and you know, you could go buy anything for cheaper. It's why is it cheaper? There's a reason. It's not because it's better necessarily. Most of the time, it's not as good as the more expensive version. And when you've got an originator like us, who originated, you know, counting turns per day, originated the dynamic locking cuff. Originated, you know, treating linings with luster lock to stop the tarnishings. You're dealing with a company that is on the cutting edge rather than the following. You know, you've got the bell-shaped curve. You've got all these people who still today, and I meet people who think that watch winders overwind watches. Now, you have far more pressure and activity on your wrist when you're walking around in a normal day, unless you just sit at your desk typing. If you're running, walking, doing stuff, you're winding your watch to a point that there's far greater than our exacting turns per day, which we go to all the watch brands. We ask them how many turns per day. We put that in our database on our website. So if you need a Mil Gauss Rolex requires 650 turns per day. My Aquaterra Omega, I think it's 1,200. It's quite heavy need for power. You set that exactly, and I can guarantee you exactly that many turns will elapse. And it's not because we use time, we use counting. So we count how many turns. That's a huge difference. You know, you wouldn't park your Aston Martin on the street. You'd put it in a garage that, you know, if you're in England, has some kind of heat in it so that it's nice and dry. Where would you put your watch? You wouldn't put it in some janky watch winder that overwound it and maybe magnetized it. You'd put it in a case that looked after it properly, that counted the exact turns per day. You could fit any watch into it because your wrist size might be large or small. The dynamic cuff will allow you to
change the size.
The cuff size will be what you need. So yeah, I mean, that's we are so far away from those guys that I don't even think about them. I really don't.
Well, I think
it's a toy.
I want to talk. I mean, we might even spend the rest of the conversation talking about watch winders because, I mean, making your bigger business is niche, but making watch winders is even more niche, right? And
define
your
niche.
Well,
what does niche
there's
mean?
Not a lot of companies that do it.
There's only one company called Apple. Would you call them niche?
I guess the volumes they make are high, right? And there's a lot of companies that make what
volume?
They do.
I mean, we make a lot of products.
Okay, well, so let's back up to some of the conversations we've had in the past years. Whereas the number of people who could use a automatic, you know, watch winder is a lot higher than the people that own them.
Oh yeah.
And the companies out there that are innovating in watch winders are really going in two directions. One of them is super high end, where it's all about this is a luxury thing. We're going to charge thousands and thousands and thousands for custom cabinet making. The watch winder is going to be fine, but because we're charging a fortune, this is for a very small number of people. And then you have a race to the bottom, which is as cheap as possible. Until recently, there wasn't much of a market for sort of a middle where it's a quality product. It's not too much more expensive than it needs to be, but it definitely doesn't have all those pitfalls you talked about, like a motor that can magnetize your watch.
Right.
And so the number of companies that make watch winders is tiny compared to the number of companies that make boxes or the number of companies that make watches. Mm-hmm. And so when I say niche, I mean the companies that specialize in it. I mean, you could probably count that on one or two hands.
Mm. Yeah.
So would you agree?
So yeah. I mean, that's a definition of niche. You know, the advantage for us is that, okay, let's call it niche, and there aren't very many in it. And I love the innovators, and there's some out there that are doing some really fun, wacky things. You know, they're not selling that many of them, and that's absolutely, you know, that's their business model, and they live where they live. And I think they support the industry. The other end of the scale, and they're about price and volume, it's also supporting it because maybe entry level, you know, someone who can't afford a Wolf is buying an entry level winder for, you know, $99, and they have an experience with it, good or bad or indifferent, but eventually they'll come to Wolf. And if you take how many Swiss, I haven't looked at the last year's results, but how many watches were made in Switzerland exported globally? In excess of 20 million. I haven't looked at the number for a while, probably 22 million. And to your point, a very few, very tiny percentage, A, own a Wolf, or B, know what a watch winder really is. And that is the exciting part for us. If you take 10% of that 2 million, 20 million, that's 2 million. We have 2 million customers that could buy a Wolf. And then you take our average price point of retail, $500-$600. It's through the math, it's huge. And so we haven't scratched the surface. So that's why when you say niche, I go, yeah, but it's huge. It's a really big business. And
well, it has potential. Niche doesn't mean that it can't grow. It just means currently it's, I guess maybe a better term would have been a boutique industry. It's a specialized boutique industry where you have a device, right? Because that's what's interesting. The box is more like, I would say, an extension of furniture making, right? Like it has to look, it has to be durable. But with a watch winder, you're combining a form of furniture making or cabinet making with consumer electronics. And those are, you know, completely different worlds. They have very little in common. But as you said, you have to make them work together. You have to make sure the parts work together and things like that. And as you said, you've had to not only do it yourself, but you've had to innovate because looking around, no one had really advanced the watch winder. And that's what I think is interesting. You know, 10 years ago, a lot has happened in the last 10 years, but 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the watch winder as a thing, outside of some very exotic, special, high-end, multiple thousand-dollar things, were basically the same thing, and no one had really improved it. Mm. No one had really invented new stuff, and you being the enterprising guy you are, I'm sure you can say, hey, you know, we got to make this a little bit better. The consumers want it, and these are improvements that can be made. Like, this is really basic stuff, and I've seen that myself. I've seen the various types of, you know, the cuffs or the pillows, as you call them, that hold, mm-hmm. the hold the watches, the different types of programming, the different types of ways that they can be powered. You know, they last a long time on batteries. I remember back in the day with Orbita, you had to use get the specialized battery. It was this complicated, weird thing. You know, plug them in now, make it simple for some of them. But mm-hmm. I think that it's become, just in recent time, more of a modern product, whereas, again, when I started this business, I mean, this watch winders, for the most part, were about as primitive as could be, right?
Mm. Yeah, and getting it out there. I mean, you're helping with that, of course. We're having an hour-long conversation that's going to focus now perhaps entirely on watch winders, and that's what your listeners, I'm sure, are most interested to hear about. And that, you know, we're a company that makes a wonderful product. We make a decent margin, but we don't have the advertising budgets. We don't have the kind of margins that the watch brands have. So we can't advertise in the same way that they do. We just don't have the ability to get into enough people's minds. So we're doing it the best way that we can. And we do advertise and we do events and we're involved with the wider community, watch community, as much as we can be. So it gets out there. So in the last decade and a bit since we first met, absolutely, there's been a sea change for us. You know, the creation of better and better product, that's really difficult to do, and then keep the consistency going when you continue to make the product. You know, being consistent, and we make a lot of product, and that, you know, we're not making just one or two references. We make 1,000 at a bare minimum to 20, 30,000 of something. Because if you do the math on 20 million, you know, watches coming out of Switzerland every year, it's actually a tiny number. I can't share exactly, but we're a huge, huge quantity that's made exactly the same over and over again. And that has led to this awareness that we now have in definitely in the world of our retailers. I don't think there are many that don't know who we are now. And the consumer is now, yeah, we're getting some traction there. But yeah, doing things like this, it's fantastic because it allows me to chat about who I am, what we are, company, and then the products. And that just gets the word out.
I mean, just going back to what I've noticed, I mean, just running down a little list since we started, talking about this, you've completely redesigned the Wolf website. You've redefined the branding, changed the logo. You have created a marketing presence, a personality for the brand. You've created slogans. You've done advertising campaigns complete with photo shoots and special themes. You've done a variety of, we'll call them engagement exercises on social media. When you go to shows, which you go to a lot, you prolifically go to them. Mm. You're not just there to have, like you said, a bunch of jewelry boxes and watch boxes and winders. You have... it's an experience. You when you see the Wolf booth, you know that. It doesn't look like anything else. It is, it's the Wolf area. Mm. And all of these things have happened in this probably last 10-year period. And it is a fundamental shift, a change. I think at the very minimum, people who have never would have thought about Wolf before, now seeing all the things you've done, they just come into it being, I'm not sure which one I want, but I'm into this brand. Like, this looks legitimate and something that people like me have in their life. And, you know, you talk about doing things slowly. That all happened very fast, didn't it?
Yeah, it's a little longer than the 10 years. It's 15 years because there was a time when I used the word magic, and I knew I had some magic, you know, the genie in the bottle sort of a thing. There was the people. It always starts with people. I started to have surround myself with better and better people who, you know, could just help me. I can't do it on my own. And that was about 15 years ago. So when we met the first time, it was starting to roll. And as the years passed, it became, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you just go out there and you just start with your dream and you don't stop and you just keep going. And when I say to people, you know, what I do for a living, on a simple level, I make boxes, you know, okay, I make boxes. Okay, how difficult is that? You know, it's not, it takes time to get better at it. And all the elements, whether it's marketing, people, production, product development, I mean, our marketing team now is absolutely fantastic. I mean, we're pushing out, we do these asset packs for all of our retailers. It is so good. I mean, we're doing a photo shoot, big, 2-day photo shoots with 2-3 models, almost monthly now. And with the celebration of the 190th, we had a photo shoot for the Silver Box. We're going on a location next week to shoot Ida. I can't tell you where it is. It's a fantastic show, photo shoot, really fairly large scale, and we'll do one for each of the subsequent 3 generations. So all those elements, you know. There are so many companies that almost got there, you know, and I don't know whether I've got there or not, but I'm still trying. You've got to have all the elements, the people, the product, the brand, the image, the department that can look after it, and the customers, of course. And if you're missing one, you're kind of limping still. And for many years now, we've just been running, and we ran right through COVID. I mean, we didn't stop. I mean, it was tough for many people. It was tough for us. We didn't actually lose any revenue year over year. We hit the same mark in 2020 as we did in 2019. So that energy that we have, we just drive and make it fun. we have as much fun as we can doing it, because if it's not fun, you don't want to do it anymore.
I want to talk about a little bit the split between the direct-to-consumer business as well as the fact that you can buy Wolf products through a variety of retailers. I guess the first question is, where do most people buy watch winders? Is it direct from you? Is it from retailers? And is it online or stores? I'm just curious what the behavior's like.
Globally, and it doesn't matter, every market's about the same, but globally, 80% of our revenue comes from the retail side of our business. And 20% comes from our own site, give or take, you know. And it breaks down. That's just revenue. If you look at watch winders, it's probably more heavily bought in retail stores. So, you know, all of our relationships globally, we probably have 4,500 accounts globally. Whether you're in, I don't know, you could be in Australia, where we have an amazing footprint through our agent down there. You could be in Manila, and our partner there is incredibly strong. You could be in India, Middle East, all over Europe. America, of course, is incredibly strong for us. Canada, Mexico. And these relationships generate the lion's share of the business. And, you know, we get pushback every now and again. Well, you know, you're taking my customer away from me. And I don't believe that for a second. The brand,
you mean by selling online?
Yeah,
you
by
mean?
Selling direct to the consumer.
I see.
You know,
yeah.
Or, you know, with the sort of numbers that are in play, with the amount of consumers that are out there, if our customer has the product on hand, they will always beat a website. Because here it is, you know, and if they're good salespeople, they'll sell it right then and there to the person who's interested in it, because that's what we want, instant gratification. So I think, you know, these connections we're making, and our website's highly informative. You can learn about the brand. You can learn about, you know, our FAQ page, you know, how many turns per day does my watch need? All those things we answer. So we're informing consumers. And the more consumers that are informed, the more the word gets out there, the more when you walk into a retailer and you see, oh, look, there's a Wolf there, you may have learned about us online and you're more inclined to buy it. It's sort of validating. So they both validate each other. So I think it's a good business for us, of course, because we sell at retail price, and I enjoy that, of course. It helps me do more advertising.
In terms of expansion and company growth, what makes more sense? Is it making more volume of what you already make? Is it expanding into new categories? Is it making more versions of what you make? I'm just curious, like, where are the correct directions to go in terms of future?
You know, our core, what we're known for is watch care. The volume in terms of units is in the jewelry case and travel area. We recently, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, went into small leather goods. It was a natural progression. So we launched W and Signature, two collections, distinct collections that are wallet and small accessory driven. And then we went into Mimi, which is women's smaller bags and purses and accessories. Again, a natural extension for us. It opens up a whole new customer base. We don't go to the same, you know, watch and jewelry retailer. We're going to fashion accessory, home gift, concept, smaller department store. And that broadening of our base of product offering is helping to grow the business. But it's astonishing the growth we still see in the watch care area. You know, that number that I mentioned earlier, you know, 20 plus million watches, and that's just Switzerland, that is being produced each year. They all need a watch box or a watch case or a watch winder. So the growth there is still, the potential is still huge. So it's more of the same, connecting with the consumer so they learn about Wolf and realize, you know, there's something very interesting in terms of a story, and the product's really good. It really will look after your watch or your jewelry. Or if, you know, we sell safes, been selling safes for a few years, and that business has taken off unbelievable. It's just a phenomenal business. And, you know, we're selling safes for anywhere from, we have a hotel safe called The Den, which I think is about $4,500. We go all the way up to $150,000, and very bespoke.
Yeah, I'm looking at them now. There's some nice safes here if you have $40,000 to spend.
Yeah, yeah. And we get an order a week for that kind of safe.
What's the difference between what the retailers and the consumers want? You're an observant guy, especially at shows. You're very curious to see how people interact with the product, and you listen to what they want. What do retailers want? What do consumers want? And how do those sometimes differ?
Interesting question, because we have all the data from our site, and then we sell Harrods and Watches of Switzerland and Neiman's and Saks and Nordstrom's. And all that data feeds back into a huge spreadsheet that we keep. And we can see exactly, when you have a full complement of Wolf product on your site, we can see what they're actually buying. We know that they're buying multiple winders. They're not buying singles. They're coming to Wolf for a triple, a four, a six, or an eight. That's not only the revenue generating area of the business, it's also the quantity as well. And so when we go to our retailers, who are always very careful, and they have to be, with what they purchase, we are trying to show them that what their consumer who's walking in the door really wants is a multiple winder. They sure will buy a Cub, for a few hundred dollars, but they're actually the more serious watch buyer, and that's who is walking in most of the time that would be interested in a watch winder. They want a larger piece, a more expensive piece, and that's great, obviously, because the revenue goes up accordingly.
Do you have any idea where people display them in their home or office? Because, I mean, the products are so nice, they should be displayed, but sometimes it's counterintuitive because where you store your watches might be, you know, a safe, secure place.
Yeah.
So I'm just, where do people keep their Wolf devices, you know?
We get pictures all the time from consumers. Hey, look at where I put my watch winder. We've had them hidden behind pictures. You know, you just slide the picture off. False walls in closets. front and center on their bureau table in their study. The kitchen. The den, it depends. We talk about circles of security. We sell safes, and they're RSC, residential security container rated. We have UL rating as well. So our safes will last for, I can't remember the numbers now, an hour and a half at 360 degrees. You can drop them. No one's getting in them. The house is burning down before anybody gets into one of our safes. The places that people put things, the way they display, depends to a degree on do they have decent security? Because as you said, you know, you might want to keep the housekeeper out of the watch winder. But then if someone's actually breaking in and have enough time, they're getting into anything that's not a steel safe. So yeah, all sorts of weird and wonderful places people put things, put our product. That's for sure.
I'm actually jealous. I would have loved to seen all those strange pictures and things like that. I'm sure you get a real hoot out of it. Like, yeah. Does that just go to like the customer service line, and every once in a while you check in, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, no, it does. It goes to, you know, our customer service folks, they build relationships and, you know, they help people with how to set the watch winder. And then they end up, you know, John ends up sending Becky in our office here in the UK a picture of the watch winder that she helped get them working properly, you know. So, yeah, a lot of fun.
What's your general relationship with the watch brands themselves? I think you've done a couple of small collaborations here or there, but do you want to work more with them, or is it sort of a better idea to be sort of your own brand and sell directly to the consumer?
Oh, we've done lots. Yeah. We did a box for Roger Dubuis. We work with Longines, Zodiac. We've done for Breitling. If you go into the boutiques, you buy a watch, you'll get a Wolf that, Breitling bought from us, and we're developing some things for them. So we have lots and lots of collaborations with the watch brands, and we love them, of course. I mean, they're the reason we exist in the watch winder business. So I love watches myself, of course, and I love what we do with them. It's we've got some very interesting things, can't talk about right now, but some interesting brands that we're working with right now, which will launch some of them later this year. So yeah, love working with them. And if any of them are listening, you know, you can always send me an email and let's start working together.
I mean, look, it's a wonderful thing when you buy a watch and you realize you're also getting something cool. I mean, the accessories that come with timepieces is really one of the most enjoyable part of the luxury buying experience. And what better to combine with a watch than a winder? Mm-hmm. Wolf, the website itself, it's just, there's so much to look at. It's a lot. You guys have done a lot, Simon. My last question has to do with, I guess, a little bit the future. How do you continue to innovate in watch winders? Because, of course, there's always new inventions and things like that. I know that you're working on things. You always are. Where would you like to innovate from a technological perspective or maybe a design perspective?
So if you look at our website and you go to the Rocket, that is a representation, a wonderful one of what
the Rocket. I got to look for the Rocket.
Yeah, just put in Rocket and you'll find it. So, you know, I woke up one morning and said to myself, we need to create a product that will fit in the palm of your hand, that you can travel with, that is as small as a watch roll and will wind your watch. And it's truly going to be a travel winder. There's been some others out there that are called, you know, travel winders, but they're not. They're too big, bulky. You got to plug them in just to make them work. So we started the development of about 3 years, almost 4 years ago. And it goes to where we're headed now. We've got several ideas that are sort of an almost impossible ask. How can you make a winder that small and it still function? And it's started with the internal workings. We had to stack the gearbox, for instance. We had to buy a slightly different size motor. We had to find a way of fitting the PC board, the printed circuit board, inside so that it would obviously fit. And all these things, we went back and forth. We do 3D printed molds, modeling. And every time it came to me from the Hong Kong engineers, I'd send it back and say, it's too big. Why don't we try this, try that? And the goal was to produce something that was tiny, as small as possible. And there's some great videos as well. If you go to YouTube, you'll see some great videos we did for this particular product. And so it's that we do.
The guy in the bathrobe, those videos?
Yeah. Yeah. You should listen to it with the sound on because it's kind of
okay.
Fun.
Okay. It's on the website right now.
We try to be a little goofy at times, not take ourselves too seriously. And so, you know, the things that I'm working on now are in the same world. They are reinventing something so that, you know, it it truly is something unique, and therefore we get notoriety from that. We get noticed because of that, and that's been a very successful product. And we have an add-on product for it that is going to allow you to make it modular.
Oh, cool!
And I can't go into it in too much detail, but it's we call it the rocket. There's going to be a docking station, and that allows you to either wall mount it, floor mount it, put it on a table. So that's you know, an example of what we've done fairly recently, and going forward, it's more of the same, being inventive.
And a lot of miniaturization and better materials and nicer designs, which is basically what I've noticed just in a couple of years from Wolf Stuff. Simon, we're out of time. I want to encourage everyone to go to the wolf1834.com website. That is where you can see all the stuff. Simon, anywhere else on the internet you think people should go to learn about the world of Wolf?
Wolf1834.com.
Very
That's
good.
That's the perfect place.
This has been the Superlative Podcast interview with Simon Wolf of Wolf1834. Simon, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care of yourself. See you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Superlative Podcast. This show relies on support from you, the audience. Please subscribe, review, and share Superlative with your friends. To get the latest watch news and enthusiast commentary, also listen to the Blog to Watch Weekly podcast. For show ideas, comments, or business, please contact us at podcasts@blogtowatch.com.